Hi, I'm here today with Francesco Chacar from the University of Southampton. Francesco, so do you want to give us a quick background as to where you're from, where you've been, and the kind of research you do?
Sure. Hello, good morning. Hi, Alex. So it is a real pleasure to be here talking to you today. So I've been invited here by Dr. René Breton, and with whom I've shared a position, let's say, in Southampton. We are both hired at the same time in the University of Southampton as lecturers, and then he moved over here, University of Manchester. So I'm a theorist, and I work mostly on the coevolution of supermassive black holes and their host galaxies. So what that means is that the universe is filled with galaxies. Each galaxy has, most probably, we believe it has at the center a supermassive black hole that is a compact, very compact object of the size comparable to the size of the solar system, and as massive as 10 to the 6 to up to a few 10 to the 9. So that means few billion solar masses. So that you can imagine taking billions of suns and compactify them in a region comparable to the solar system. That is a supermassive black hole. And these have been detected dynamically by measuring the velocity of stars or gas at the very center of galaxies, or at least those galaxies that we can resolve with telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope. And by measuring the dynamics of stars and gas at the very center of these galaxies, we can then infer the mass of the central dark object. Because it's a black hole, you usually don't see it directly. You can't, but you can infer its presence by his gravitational influence on the surrounding environment.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So one of the main things you just said was that we expect these supermassive black holes to be in every galaxy. Is that something which astronomers are fairly confident of, that literally in the center of every galaxy we expect this object?
Yeah, so this is actually a good question. So we don't think that we are living in a special region of the universe. We think that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. That means it has similar features in all directions. So if we are looking at properties of galaxies within the local volume of the universe, we don't expect this to be different from any other region in the universe, just because of this isotropy of the universe. So because our technology, present technology, allows us to measure black holes only in some special galaxies. That means that special in the sense that they are close enough to us that we can actually see the very center of these galaxies and resolve with Hubble in their center. So they are special in this respect, but not for any other reason. And so that is the reason why astronomers believe that each galaxy should have a central black hole. Our own galaxy, our Milky Way, does have a supermassive black hole. In fact, the measurement that we now have of the center of the Milky Way is one of the tightest constraints we have on a supermassive black hole.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting point actually, that because obviously the black hole in our back garden in the Milky Way is obviously fairly close by, in the context of then, if you want to find other black holes, they're going to be in other galaxies and hence many, many megaparsecs away, and obviously then much harder to resolve, right?
That's right.
So you in your talk, you were doing physics with a sample of these supermassive black holes. How many galaxies were you working with when you
That's
did that?
right. So far, astronomers have been able to collect a sample of, say, around 80 galaxies with dynamical measurements of supermassive black holes. So what that means, dynamical means that their masses have been inferred from the dynamics, as I said before, of the surrounding stars or gas. Now, these are extremely challenging measurements. So this is the reason why, even after decades of studies and efforts from the astronomical community, we only rely on a handful of these galaxies.
So what exactly do they measure when they look at these far-off galaxies with their black holes?
Right. So it can, the measurements, the techniques to measure black holes dynamically are different. In our own Milky Way, which is the best measurement, it was just the dynamics of the very central stars that are orbiting around the Sagittarius A, the very center of our own galaxy. In other galaxies, you infer the dynamics, like, for example, using some gas, like in M87, which is at the center of the Virgo cluster, the very bright elliptical, which is at the center of the Virgo cluster. There you can measure, in fact, you can infer the mass by measuring the Doppler effects, that means the velocities of the surrounding gas at the very center. In other ways, in other galaxies, you need to rely on other techniques, such as using the so-called Poisson equation. So that means you measure the light profile of the galaxy from down to the very center, you transform this into a mass profile, and then you can transform it into a density, you can relate this to the potential, and by solving the equations of potential and density, you can then infer what dynamics of the very central region you need, that means what mass you need at the very central regions, to recover both the mass density that you observe and the potential and the velocities of stars that you observe. So it's a more complicated technique, which is a bit more involved, but still that's the best we can do now.
And they do all this mostly with the Hubble Space Telescope?
Yeah, mostly with the Hubble Space Telescope, because you need telescopes to be in space, first of all, in order to avoid the problems of seeing and from the atmospheric seeing of the Earth. And then you need obviously instruments that they are in space, and they need to be built in such a way that they can provide you with the best resolution as possible. And clearly Hubble has been a big improvement in our view of the universe.
So in your talk, you have this sample of 80 galaxies, and you were talking about relationships between the mass of the host galaxy as a whole and the mass of the black hole that's at the center. And you saying that, you know, the past decade or two or longer, people have sort of sought out this relationship between the two and how one can affect the other. So before we get on to exactly how you might be changing these ideas, could you give us a quick history of what people have thought so far?
That's right. So in the last 30 years or so, there have been thousands and thousands and really thousands of papers from the astronomical community, from both theorists and observers, in trying to describe and give a meaning to the correlations, putative correlations, that have been observed between the mass of the black hole and, in fact, the mass of the whole galaxy, of the host galaxy, or its velocity dispersion, that means the random motions of stars. What has been observed so far by astronomers is that there seems to be a rather tight correlation between, if you plot mass of the black hole on the y-axis, and on the x-axis you plot the mass of the galaxy or its velocity dispersion, you see that all these points get aligned into a more or less defined line. And this correlation takes the name of the so-called coevolution of black holes and galaxies. So because there is this correlation between these two different systems, so let me say that these are very different scales we are talking about. The black hole is at the very center of the galaxy. It's sub-parsec scales, and the galaxy is at kiloparsec scale. So as I said in my talk, it's basically you are comparing a grape, the size of the grape, to the size of the Earth. So, but these two systems that are so different from each other, they know about each other. At least this is what people have seen by plotting these quantities together. And so theorists and observers have tried to understand these properties, and these data brought together two communities that were not really working together before, but now they've been working together in the last 20 years or so, the community of the galaxy evolution side and the community of the AGN side. They were work, and then they brought together because they thought, now they think that there is a clear coevolution of these two systems, and we need to work together to understand it.
Yeah. Cool. So sounds like there's a very keen interest in this area of physics with people, I guess, to mention that both theorists and observationalists are really trying very hard to tackle this.
Yes.
So the interesting point that you've come to Manchester to discuss was how you have a slightly different take. You've sort of taken a step back and said, okay, we see this correlation, but let me just look at it from maybe a different angle. So what was your take on this?
That's right. Scenario? So we have just published a paper on the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, and there will be a press release in May on our results organized by the journal. So we have, in fact, allow me to say, discovered a new property of these scaling relations. In fact, what we claim is that there is no correlation at all, at least in stellar mass. And the only correlation that really exists between black holes and galaxies is only with velocity dispersion. We were able to conclude this by using different techniques, statistical techniques. Monte Carlo tests, we ran a lot of Monte Carlo simulations, as well as we have done tests on the so-called residuals on the data. So basically, if a variable depends on other two variables, we fix one variable and we take the residuals around the mean, and we correlate the residuals to test which is the most fundamental property linked to the black hole mass in the specific case. So all these tests are showing us that because of some pre-selection that was made by observers on these 80 galaxies, and this pre-selection means only the best galaxies, that means the best resolved galaxies were measured with the dynamical mass of the black hole, this led to a significant bias, observational bias in the sample. So this sample is not fully representative of, in fact, the full underlying the population of local supermassive black holes. And we have demonstrated this in our paper. In fact, the sample shows that at fixed stellar mass, these galaxies, the specific host of these supermassive black holes, tend to have significantly higher velocity dispersions with respect to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is a survey of the whole local universe. So in the Sloan, we have millions of galaxies. We compare the properties of these galaxies with the properties of the host of supermassive black holes, and we have identified some differences, some key differences. And these key differences can be fully explained by selection effects. Now, once you have taken fully into account the selection effects, you can still demonstrate that there is a clear dependence between black hole mass and host galaxy properties. But this, the only relation that we have found so far is with velocity dispersion, and the relation that people observe with stellar mass, it's actually not true, not real. It's a selection effect.
Ah, okay, yeah. So the selection effect, I guess, is quite a common theme in astronomy, in that, you know, we try and observe many things out there in the universe, and obviously we're limited by how clever we are in building instruments to observe them. So clearly we can't see everything. So so in this case, we're seeing, you know, these 80 or so galaxies with the Hubble, which is a great instrument, but, you know, it's
still not perfect.
It's still, you know, yeah, you could build something that was 100 times bigger than Hubble, and then you'd get maybe less biased results. So just to hone in on some of those points you mentioned. So you're saying that the mass of the host galaxy, so this line they see where they see the mass of the host galaxy and the mass of the black hole, you're saying that that's just a byproduct of the bias, and in fact it's not a correct correlation, and that in fact it's the velocity dispersion that's the key parameter.
Yes. So clearly in a galaxy, especially in an elliptical galaxy, which is a typical host of massive black holes, the velocity dispersion is correlated to stellar mass and in fact also size through the so-called fundamental plane of ellipticals, which is basically the virial theorem, gm over r equal sigma square proportional to sigma square. This is basically the general equation for any gravitating system in equilibrium. And ellipticals do obey this relation, so there is a correlation between velocity dispersion and stellar mass. But the point is, which is the most fundamental property linked to black holes, and what physical mechanism is actually driving these correlations? So this was the main question, okay, that pushed theoretical models in the last 20 years to try and answer this type of observations and this type of modeling. So what we find is that velocity dispersion, that means the random motion of stars around the center of mass of the galaxy, of the host galaxy, that is the key parameter. And that can be, allow me to say, easily explained, or there is a natural explanation for this, which comes from the so-called quasar feedback. This was a model which, in fact, was put forward, the very first model or explanation was put forward in the late 90s, even before the M sigma relation was actually proposed by observers. Already theorists like Joe Silk and Martin Rees had come up with this bright idea that black holes should correlate with velocity dispersion of the stars because of the so-called quasar feedback. That means black holes, when they accrete gas, they can be the central engine of quasars, of luminous quasars. I will come back to that in a moment, but if that is the case, at the moment of their quasar phase, they can inject so much energy in the surrounding medium within the dynamical time of the host galaxy that can impact seriously the evolution of the host galaxy by, for example, halting, completing the star formation rate in the galaxy, for example. So this can create this link between black holes and galaxies, so those two different scales, and this quasar feedback, it can be shown, it naturally provides the correlation between black hole mass and velocity dispersion.
Right, yeah. So quasars, let's just quickly just give a 15-second explanation of what exactly a quasar is and does.
Yes, so a quasar is one of the most luminous sources in our universe. They are observed up to very high redshift, redshift 6 or 7. So quasars are beasts, luminous beasts, that we believe they are powered by accretion onto a central supermassive black hole. That's what a quasar is. And the black hole is extremely efficient in providing this. The reason why we believe it's a supermassive black hole, because this engine is very efficient in producing luminosity. So when the black hole accretes gas, it becomes very efficient and it can release a lot of energy, much more than nuclear reactions. Order of magnitudes more efficient than nuclear reactions in stars.
So what sort of percentage efficiency are we talking about for these?
So this is what I'm talking about is around 10, 20, 30% efficiency with respect to 0.008 of so fractions of percents of what you expect from nuclear reactions.
Wow. Yes, yeah, so that's really sort of, yeah, you don't realize in these nuclear reactors how inefficient they are, really.
And yes.
Most of the energy is not released in an efficient manner. And then you look at these objects in the universe, these supermassive black holes, where you've got lots of gas falling in, accreting onto them, and then they're really just pumping out light, basically, at 10, 20, 30% efficiencies, and that's really quite staggering in efficiency to convert potential energy into luminosity.
That's correct.
So this whole process, if it's so efficient, it can then clearly feed back into the galaxy. So is it the case that the So this velocity dispersion, this high randomness movement of stars, is it the case that the supermassive black hole causes the large velocity dispersion of the stars, or is it the case that you only see the largest black holes in galaxies which already have large velocity dispersion?
Well, we don't yet have a clear answer to this question, but we believe that it's a self-regulated process. So both systems are growing together during the quasar phase. So the galaxy is forming stars, the black hole is accreting gas and it's growing, until the quasar feedback kicks in and then halts star formation, and at the same time it halts the accretion on the black hole, and the black hole basically starts starving from that point onwards. But again, the details of this process is extremely delicate and difficult to model. Mm-hmm. And there are several groups in the world that are trying to understand this in detail using different techniques, different hydro simulators, and it's a very difficult problem. But yes, the basic idea is the following, that there is a self-regulating mechanism happening over there at that moment.
Okay, then, so having sort of come up with this idea that we're now... So from the sample of 80 galaxies, you now have this relationship which can predict black hole masses. That's the difficult thing to measure. So if we can have a relationship to predict that, that's great, because we can, if we've got a relationship between black hole mass and other properties, we can then predict black hole masses for other galaxies. Okay. So what implications does that have for the wider community of astrophysics, where black hole mass is clearly an important parameter for many parts of astrophysics? How is this going to impact
the
wider community?
Yes, this is a good question. So our results have a series of implications. So let me give you a few examples, key examples. One is, clearly we now have a better understanding of what's the interplay between black holes and galaxies, so which is quasar feedback and the M-sigma relation. So this is impacting the field of galaxy evolution a lot. This is one of the first. The second is that, on average, our results show that black holes should be, on average, less massive than what previously thought. In terms of stellar mass, at fixed stellar mass, black holes could be a factor of 10, or at low masses even up to 100, less massive than what previously thought from the direct measurements. This would imply that if, for example, the gravitational waves expected from black hole mergers should be less strong than what previously, proportionally less strong than what previously thought, and this might explain the why so far we have still not detected from pulsar timing arrays any gravitational waves coming from supermassive black holes. This might be because the overall population of black holes is less massive than what we think, and therefore again the efficiency of creating gravitational energy is less. The chirp mass associated to each pair of supermassive black holes is less, proportionally less than what people thought before, and this at fixed merger rate still provides less signal. And this might be a solution to why we still do not detect anything from pulsar timing arrays. And another point is that the fact that the black hole masses are less reduced should also imply that to provide the same quasar emissivity, integrated emissivity, as we observe it in the universe, should imply that supermassive black holes are rapidly spinning. So there is a correlation between the geometry of supermassive black holes and their efficiency. This comes from GR, from general relativity, and in practice, the more spinning the black hole, the more efficient the black hole is expected to be. The reason is because the particle can get closer and closer to the rotation axis and still be stable and be able to emit energy. And so the reason our measurements of lower mass densities of black holes should imply that on average black holes are more should be more efficient to produce the same amount of emissivity of quasars that we actually observe. And this implies that possibly all supermassive black holes on average should be so-called Kerr black holes. That means they have a geometry that is identified with spinning black holes.
So that it sounds like this result will have quite a, particularly with gravitational waves, a quite a big impact. I think we're fortunate enough to have already seen gravitational waves, so that's at least you're only hurting the pulsar the pulsar teams that are hunting for them. Okay, so one of the last things, looking to the future, you've done this study with a sample of 80, and you think you're understanding the statistics of this sample very well now, which has enabled you to draw the conclusions that you have. Looking to the future, obviously increasing this sample size would be great. Can you see that happening, or is it, have we sort of reached a limit where of the instrumentation where a sort of Hubble, and we really need sort of a next generation of telescopes to be able to increase that sample
size? Yeah, that's correct. So we will need to wait telescopes like ELT, 30 meter telescopes, possibly, to really make a step forward in this direction to really realize the impact of this bias observationally. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for talking to us today, Francesco. It's been a pleasure. Also, it's great to welcome you here because I started my PhD in Southampton around about the same time as when you started Southampton.
That's correct, yes.
And then I moved up to Manchester sort of halfway through my PhD, so it's good to see you up here. And I'm sure we'll cross paths again soon. But thanks for joining us today for the Jodcast.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you.